good activity.
Yeah, when I was really into Legos, I would get the Legos, you know, and sit on a desk and put on like a podcast or maybe like a show that I've seen a million times and I just like listening to, like The Toys That Made Us. And just, you know, I think there's something about like you have a book, you have a pile of nothing, and then you have a book, and the book says, do this, do that, do that, do that. And you go, okay, I'll do it. And then you do it. And it makes a fun snapping noise, and it feels good. The vibration feels good on your fingers. It's like a snap. And then eventually it starts to look like something. Like, there's, you might know this moment, but since you just are getting into Legos, but like, there's a moment where it goes, where you start to see it. There's a moment where it goes from a you know, a block of clay to David. And you're like, there it is. I see it. I see it emerging.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know. I know you did a lot of these, but this is the first time I did Lego since I was a kid.
Nice.
And I think as a kid, I was just like fucking around with the bricks. Like I wasn't actually building stuff. So this time I was like, okay, I have to build this and figure it out.
Yeah.
And there's a moment where I'm just like, I don't know what the hell I'm doing. And then it changes and you get something. And I got these like, beautiful, you know, little botanicals that are on my desk and they look cute.
Yeah.
And it's also nice to do something that you don't have that push for, to turn that enjoyment into some kind of hustle or way to make money.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I feel like anytime I've heard someone.
Yes, I'm still with you.
Yeah, that's cool. I feel like anytime I've heard someone or had a conversation about, oh, I like doing this thing, the first response from someone is always like, well, why don't you do that for money? And I'm just like, you can't just enjoy
it on YouTube.
Stuff. It's like, we have no money anymore. Our jobs don't pay enough of a living wage that we have to do other things in addition to that with the hopes that we can get more money because life is awful. It's just enjoy something. You know?
It's hard because none of us can just live on one job or two. But look at this.
Oh my goodness, you got the Starry Night. I love it. That's gorgeous.
I got the Starry Night Lego. It's, you know, you make a frame and it's like 3D, the spires and stuff. And I don't know if I've said this on the show, but let me tell you something real basic bitch about me. Starry Night's my favorite painting.
Whoa. Okay.
That's a real basic bitch thing to say.
No, but tell us about it. Why Starry Night?
Okay, well, I was just putting the Lego away. It's beautiful. You've seen it, right? It's at MoMA. It's shockingly small when you see it. You're like, wow, that's it. And you know, as somebody who has depression and anxiety, I appreciate making beauty out of torment. And you know, I'm a real like, you know, I'm a real curate the world the way you want to see it kind of person. So the idea, his, you know, Van Gogh's aesthetic, I really like.
Yeah, I like him
too. Basic, you know? You know what I mean? Like, I don't have a favorite, like, Caravaggio. You know what I mean? I got that book. You know that book? Wait, you know it. Hold on. Today's like show and tell. I'm showing.
On an audio podcast, yes.
Yeah. Are you familiar with this book? I feel like every nerd tries
the
to get it.
The art book. No, actually, I'm not. But I like Phaidon. I have some of their collections.
This book is like, maybe like it's a few years ago, but like there was a point where like you needed this on your coffee table. It's basic. It's called the art book. It's a giant, expensive ass book. And it's basically, it's alphabetical order every artist. Every artist worth knowing and like a few pieces of their work. And when I bought it, I told myself I will look at it every day and learn a new artist every day. And I haven't. Actually, you know who's an artist I really like? What's her name? And by the way, I think this all will lead us nicely into what we're going to talk about today. Aft Klimt. No, there's Klimt, and then there's Klimt the guy who did like the Kiss, and then there's like someone named like Aft Klimt or Klimt.
Oh wait, the female artist, right?
Right. She thought that God was coming through her. Her work was like, this is God. And it was like just crazy shapes.
Which I'm like, why not?
Oh, it's like the second page of the book. Oft Klint. Oft Klint.
Yeah, Hilma Oft Klint.
Yes.
There's a really good documentary, and it was kind of cheesy, but there is a fictional drama about her work too. She kind of like made an art group, and like these women would make these giant paintings with her. Kind of like a cult, but not really, like an art commune.
I love it.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. And she was doing that abstract work before the men were doing abstract art. Like, she was so ahead of her time. And it's also just really great. Like, looking at art is, it gives so much. Why not?
Especially in these dark times. But
Yes.
speaking of art and speaking of cults,
Okay.
today we're here to talk about a movie that maybe is about a cult. It's about a cult that couldn't get off the ground. We're talking today about the 2025 documentary Mega Doc, directed by Mike Figgis, who his biggest movie was Leaving Las Vegas with Nicolas Cage. And Mega Doc is a documentary, a feature-length documentary about the making of Francis Ford Coppola's Megalopolis. Now, raise your hand if you've seen Megalopolis. Neither me or Nadia are raising our hands.
Who has? Nobody.
Nobody has. I don't know. I didn't say this. Nadia caters our guests. Welcome, Nadia.
Hey man, I'm going on mic and saying I would rather have diarrhea than watch Megapolis.
All right. So I was going to watch it, right? But guess what? It's not streaming anywhere because crazy Francis Ford Coppola feels like it should only be seen in theaters. So,
Not even physical release,
no, it is
just
physical. You
theaters.
could buy a Blu-ray. He just won't let
Oh.
it stream.
Oh my God.
I've heard secondhand things from people. No one ever says anything great about it. It seems like people either say it's utter, sad, tragically trash, or it's insane trash that's just joyful. And then there are some people that are like, oh no, he's just like on a level you don't understand. He's like Hilma af Klint. He's on a le he's God's coming through him, which I don't know about all that.
Who the hell is saying that?
Yeah, I saw some kiss ass interviewer interviewing Coppola, and he goes, you know, this movie is like in a different key. And I was like, shut the fuck up.
My God.
This Mega Doc is featured on Criterion Channel right now, and it's entertaining. You know, I the fact that I haven't seen it or you haven't seen it, I think means almost nothing actually, because we've seen this, and that's what's in, this is probably much more interesting,
I
because
agree.
this is like a Moby Dick esque tale of an old man's obsession going after the white whale that he never could quite get. Megalopolis is a film based on a script directed by written by Francis Ford Coppola, of course the guy who did Godfather and The Conversation and Apocalypse Now, and of course his forever classic Jack, starring starring Robin Williams, and Dracula, my favorite Dracula. By him. Love his Dracula.
Oh, yeah.
Unapologetically love his Dracula.
I love it more than the book.
I've never read the book.
Really? I thought you have.
I've read Frankenstein. Frankenstein.
Well, Frankenstein is brilliant.
Yeah.
Dracula is basically like,
Trash.
well, I think the gist of the story is just Dracula like breaking into this woman's house and then leaving and coming back. It's like, all right.
Oh. Well, it's also like the weird BDSM fantasy of like a bottom, right? Because Bram Stoker was a theater agent for like this very famous actor who like treated him like total shit. And he clearly bases Dracula on that guy.
That's hilarious. I didn't know
Yeah. Anyway, so Francis Ford Coppola's been trying to make this for 30 years. No one wanted to make it with him. He doesn't have a lot of independent films yet. Francis Ford Coppola has, for the filmmaking community, sort of stood as a pillar in the idea of independent filmmaking because he was one of the first film brats, which is the first generation of popular directors to go to film school. So like Francis Ford Coppola, Martin Scorsese, Steven Spielberg, George Lucas, Brian De Palma, but he's actually like a little bit older than all those other guys. And he also created a company really early on called American Zoetrope, which like was his megalopolis, because he had all these high-minded ideals, and he was like, we're gonna do amazing things with this. And I think American Zoetrope only produced like three films before completely folding. They did THX 1138, I think, and then I think they also did Lucas's American Graffiti. But then like the money went dry, and then he was broke, and then so he took The Godfather, he was broke, and then that became what he did. And so he's not like someone who is like a lifelong independent filmmaker like Abel Ferrara or somebody, but he somehow still stands as like a patron saint of independent filmmaking. But Megalopolis is truly an independent film because he sold off a large majority of where he gets his money to live, which is the wineries that he owns. The
Which is
movie
shit wine, by the way. Like
is
it's
it?
if anyone's like into wine, and I've had to ask a few people, for Coppola's wine is shit.
Really? I'm not a wine drinker. I did see the Patrick H. Willems video where he watched all the Francis Ford Coppola movies and would pair them with one of his wines. That was a fun bit.
Jeez.
Coppola, the movie begins with Coppola being interviewed by his wife, Ellen. Is it Eleanor?
Yeah.
No, or Ellie? What is, no, is it Eleanor? What's his wife's name?
It's Eleanor, but
Okay.
I think he probably called her Ellie or something, but
Yeah. He's talking to her and he's saying, Jacques Tati died penniless because he funded his last film. And he's like, who cares if you die penniless if you make great art? Have you ever seen Jacques Tati movies?
yeah. Can I remember any of them? No, but
They all kind of meld together. He's like a more subtle Mr. Bean. It's a lot of like, it's kind of like a silent, it, they're kind of like silent comedies with sound, if that makes any sense to you.
now that you're saying that, I'm getting like pictures in my brain. I'm like, oh yeah, I've watched this stuff.
I really like Playtime. Playtime's a really good one.
I think that's his most famous one too.
He built a city. Like that whole city, he built it. And this is why he died penniless. So there's so much to say. Let me ask you this, Nadia. What are your
Yes.
fe before this documentary, what are your feelings about Francis Ford Coppola and his oeuvre? Do you have a favorite Frankie Ford movie?
Frankie Ford. I don't think anyone's ever called him that.
You get kicked off the set. Frankie!
Like, get the fuck off my set. Looking at his movies, as we both mentioned, we have not seen Megapolis, and we are not interested, which is fine. I haven't seen Apocalypse Now. I just heard about it and I watched Heart of Dark, like the documentary on it, which
Yeah.
the Megadoc had a lot of that in it.
Right,
It's interesting.
right.
But looking at like Coppola's filmography, I think my favorites of his are Dracula and The Conversation. I think The Conversation's great.
Yes, I didn't mention that. The conversation is great.
I will
Conversation.
say though, I have not seen The Godfather.
Really?
I know.
I haven't seen One from the Heart. Is that what it's called?
Yeah, haven't seen that one either.
I haven't seen that one. I don't think I've seen Rumblefish or he also did Outsiders too, right?
Yeah, I think I watched like a few clips from it when my middle school was reading The Outsiders. I don't think I've
Yeah.
seen it. Jack was a movie that I think used to play on cable, so I
Yeah.
remember it, but I don't remember it being good.
Yeah.
A few years ago, I watched Peggy Sue Got Married, which is just a very
Oh,
weird
yeah.
movie.
Yeah, I haven't seen that either. I guess I haven't seen a lot of his movies. I
Yeah,
do
I
like the
don't have.
Godfather movies.
He directed two of them, right? He didn't
No,
direct
he
the third
directed
one.
all of them.
Oh, okay.
The
Oh,
third
yeah.
one is considered bad, but I think that's wrong. And the second one is considered like the best movie ever, and I think that's wrong. I like the second one, but I don't, it's not my favorite. It would be my third favorite, I have to say. The first Godfather 1, I think is worth watching. It is very good. And he is an iconoclast. Like, you see the Godfather 1 and you're like, okay, this guy is doing, like, I could see what this guy's doing, and he's firing all cylinders, and that's not what's happening in Megalopolis. Let me ask this. Let me ask, and I'll admittedly say this is an ageist question.
Sure.
Is there a point where it's gone? Is there, like, is a movie too much of a endeavor physically and mentally that an octogenarian? Here's another, all right, here's another question. How many great films have been made by octogenarians?
God, I don't know.
You know what I
What?
mean?
Well, I'm thinking like, okay, when did Kurosawa die?
Okay.
I feel like if he made a movie in his 80s, was probably pretty good, but I'm guessing. I have no idea. Did you figure this out?
No, I'm Googling it now, though.
I mean the age thing definitely, but I think a bigger part of it is when you obsessively think about an idea for literal decades of your life and you try to make it over and over again, right? Because they showed in Megadoc, which I thought was a great addition, was that they would do the screen tests and table reads from different iterations of the script with different actors. You could see like the time frames of like what were the actors of that time trying to work on this movie that didn't get made like multiple times. I thought that was really interesting, but
Yes.
I think he put so much, and I think this happens a few times when directors who can do this, is that they put so much of their energy and obsession with making something,
Yeah.
it's never going to be as good as they think it's going to be.
Yes. I think he, all right, maybe I should take it out of ageism. Maybe it's not about ageism, although he's clearly physically slower in the movie. But it could be, like you said, just too much obsessing. Like, when he was younger, he probably would have played it from the hip a little bit more, whereas it's too much all in his head now. Like, when you see the footage in the documentary of, like, early table reads or early screen tests he did, like, he did, there's footage of screen tests of scenes that he did with Ryan Gosling in 2003 playing the Shia LaBeouf role. And that shit looks so much better than what Shia LaBeouf does. And then there was another table read that they, what he did in like 1998 or something.
Yeah, Virginia Madsen. I was like, this is the most 90s
Yeah.
actor.
Robert De Niro playing the role, that John Voight played, the Aubrey Plaza role being played by Uma Thurman. Like, it all seems better. I do think the casting, and again, I shouldn't be talking bad about a movie I haven't seen, but you do see them film a lot of it. And whenever you hear them film, whenever you hear them talk, whenever you hear dialogue, you're like, oofah. That's what's really funny, because this documentary is all of like, oh, the art, this is going to change the world. And then you'll see like a scene being filmed, and they're like, hey, who farted on my dictionary? Oh, was it you? Ah, you're gonna go to jail. And you're like, what is,
Pick
what?
up my
How is
fucking
this gonna,
hat.
yeah, pick up my, yeah, how is this gonna change the world, Francis?
I think like back to like what you were we were talking about art earlier. I think if you're an artist, and Coppola is an artist, If you're an artist who believes your one piece is going to change the world, someone got to knock you down a few pegs. Like,
Yes.
absolutely not. Like the art that we've talked about, you talked about Starry Night. I'm pretty sure Van Gogh wasn't going around with his friends of like, this fucking thing
Yeah.
gonna change the world.
Right. Right.
Like, how full of yourself can you be?
He's very full of himself, Francis Ford Coppola. And I think the other thing is this. He seems to have this idea, and George Lucas used to say this a lot too, and look where it got him, that if I fund it myself with my own money, I'll have complete creative control, and it'll be this urtext. It'll be this perfect motion picture. But in fact, what happens in practice is when you fund it yourself, you have to have two minds. You have to have the mind of the director and the artist, but then at the same time, the mind of the guy with the purse. There are scenes in this movie where Coppola's like, "This all costs too much. Why are there so many trucks? What are we doing?" And it's like, clearly, like, this is why we had the other model. Like, yes, when someone else pays for it, they might tell you to cut something out and they might stifle your auteurish genius by giving you a note, God forbid, right? I'm so aggressive towards the auteur theory,
Done.
but when you don't, but when you don't do it in practice, you know, you're being pulled out of it. And it's interesting. At one point, Aubrey Plaza is saying that he's a man of contradictions. You know, he's at one time like very, very controlling of do it exactly what I want. Give me what I want. There's a scene where he's shouting at Shia LaBeouf saying, "Give me what I want. I've been doing this for 50 years." And Shia LaBeouf's like, "I don't know what you want." And then there are other times where he's like, "Improvise. Imagine you're the Wicked Queen. Say this now, do the scene, but pretend she's a fly and you're a spider." So it's like sometimes he's super collaborative and then sometimes he's not at all. And then I think the other main contradiction is sometimes he's an artist who wants to waste time trying to make something happen. Like he spends a whole day trying to make some weird light effect happen that just is not possible with our physics. So they end up doing it CGI anyway. And then there are other times where he's mad because things take too long. And he's worried about money. It's like paying for your own movie is not good. Movies need to be collaborative. I'm sorry, folks. That's one of the things that makes movies special.
It's a collaborative art.
Yeah.
It's also like funny when he is definitely in contradiction, but it also seems like there's no one that reels him in. Like
Yes.
it kind of seems like I'm not saying that she had to do this, but it feels like there should have been some point where Eleanor was like, slow down.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe don't keep people here for 73 days of filming. That when that text
Yeah.
came up. Day 70, film day
Yeah.
73. So I almost lost my mind. I was like,
Yeah.
how are these people doing this? There's also
Yeah.
something so insulting to be like, oh, play with it when there's hundreds of people around you doing the special effects, doing
Yeah.
the camera work, getting the lighting and the audio. Like, that's not play for them. They
Yeah.
have to figure out what you want.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there was a point where like they fired I think the art director and
Yeah.
like the special effects people quit
Yeah,
like
the whole
midway through.
department went with her.
That's crazy. And it's really sad because when they first interviewed her,
Oh,
she was
yeah.
like ecstatic. And she was
Yes.
talking about like, I s took a picture of the screen, I sent it to my family. Like, this is a big opportunity to work
Yeah.
with Coppola.
And she
And
does Marvel movies. She had done Guardians of the Galaxy, but she was so excited to do this. And he had all of this pie in the sky, big talk about it being this epic. So she was like, "Oh, I could use what we have. I could use CGI and our modern tools to give him this epic." And then when they got there, he didn't want it. He wanted it to be as practical as possible. And she was like, "Well, we." She felt like she when they do her kind of like quote unquote exit interview after she's fired, she's kind of like, "You know, I'm saying I'm unhappy that I couldn't give him what he wanted, but I do feel like he said something different at the beginning."
yeah. Which that happens when an unchecked ego has all this money to spend.
Yeah.
Like you got there's a kind of phrase I like to throw around, especially I throw it at work too. It's like through constraint there's opportunity.
Yes.
And
That's
you
his
could
cinema.
yeah, I just think in I'm like I know it's like a stupid comparison, but I've been watching a lot of interviews lately like about productions, and one thing that really like stuck in my mind of just I was watching this interview with Sandy King Carpenter, so she's the producer on a lot of Carpenter, John Carpenter's movies. And she was just talking about, oh yeah, like we never went over budget. We'll go at or under, and we don't want to film for too long. So like, and just talking about the different movies she worked on him with, and I feel like overall they come out better for that. So it's wild to see like, and Coppola, he's this huge, and his fan, he had such a big influence in his family, just all everyone's like a secret Coppola. Do you know Jason Schwartzman's a Coppola?
Yes, I did.
I didn't know that.
His mother's Talia Shire from the Rocky movies and Godfather. Yeah, and his son Roman Coppola is working on this. He's the second unit director. And he's directed his own movies. He's also co-written movies with Wes Anderson.
So like it's wild, but it's sort of like I feel like the actors were also kind of trapped in that, because imagine if you like tell off Coppola, what would happen to your career?
Well, I never thought that I would say this, but the person that I come out liking the most is Shia LaBeouf.
I was thinking that too.
If you've seen anything of this documentary, you might have seen on TikTok or Reels, the big moments of this documentary are these very, very tense, argumentative moments between Francis Ford Coppola and Shia LaBeouf, where and Shia LaBeouf is like. He's in. He's got this. He's an odd guy too, and he's got this like very like artistic, kind of a blunt thing about him, and he'll ask Coppola like why, like oh that doesn't make sense. Why wouldn't this happen? Explain to me what I'm supposed to be doing. And as the movie goes on, it just their relationship gets worse and worse and worse. Where at the beginning he's very he you could tell that he's annoying Coppola, but at the same time, Coppola is okay with it. But then towards the end, he like walks away from him. At one point, Coppola goes and directs from his trailer, and then he they get to a big screaming match, and he says like, you're the worst actor I've ever worked with. You're the most difficult actor I've ever worked with. And Charles Wolf's like, I'm more difficult than Marlon Brando, who showed up like 100 pounds overweight. In Apocalypse Now,
I think
like,
he said like 700 pounds. Like he was really exaggerating.
which is true.
So funny. But that also that scene where like Francis is directing from his like they called it something too. It wasn't
The
even like
silverfish.
his silver vision. It's a trailer that has a bunch of movies on it, and one of the bumper stickers is like of Jack, and I'm like, is this something to be proud
It's
of?
all of his movies, like in their fonts. And it's like, wow, okay.
There's that scene reminded me of there's a 30 Rock joke where Tina Fey comes to the set and Pete the producer is like Tracy's really phoning it in today, and Tina's like, what else is new? And he's like, no, literally. And his Tracy's assistant is holding a cell phone, and it's like he's responding to Jenna's lines like through the phone.
Yeah, that's how he was directing certain scenes.
Which I text you about this. I'm like, it's shocking that this isn't a mockumentary because it's so absurd. And that's actually what makes it brilliant, because it's so painfully absurd and strange. But I was like, man, this would make a great Christopher Guest movie. Like,
Well, I was wondering to myself, this comes out in 2025 and Megalopolis came out in 2024. And in case you're wondering, Megalopolis has a 46% in Rotten Tomatoes and Megadoc has 98% in Rotten Tomatoes. And I find myself wondering because it also has like a very jazzy score. And there's something downbeat about the whole thing. I found myself wondering, had Megalopolis been successful, would this all have been edited in a different way? Because it feels like what he's documenting is a monumental failure.
That's an interesting point.
I mean, I think it pretends to be objective, and I think I don't think it's like, what do you call it? Like a gotcha piece, you know what I mean? Or hit piece. But I also don't think it goes out of its way to make Coppola good at all. Like, there's a scene, right, where there's this weird scene going on where they're improvising and Coppola's like telling this guy, like in a soldier outfit, he's like, take off your coat and go sell it to one of the extras. And Shia LaBeouf, who's not even in the scene, comes and sits next to him and he's like, what is this? Like, is this necessary? This is just some bullshit from your childhood. And then he's like, Shia, you're full of shit. And then Shia starts laughing, but then underneath there's text on the screen that says, this in fact is from his childhood. So the director of the documentary is like, yeah, Shia's right. And then Shia's like, you fixate on shit. And he's like, I can't talk to you right now. They're so get under each other's skin.
There's this really great scene where I call it a scene, like just a captured moment where Francis Ford Coppola is arguing with Shia LaBeouf about what movies are, and he just keeps
Oh, yeah.
hammering this point of like, it's just lights, it's fake. Those people aren't real on that screen. And then Shia LaBeouf was like, what? But what do you, but the director of oh my goodness, what was that divorce movie? Kramer versus Kramer. He's
Yeah.
like, but the director was going through a d divorce and they
Yeah.
captured it on screen.
Yeah.
And I was like, I never thought I agree with Shia LaBeouf of
Yeah.
anything. He makes the most sense.
Yeah, I never thought that Francis Ford Coppola would have a really flippant, like, idea about what movies are. And maybe it was just for the context of that conversation, because he was just trying to get Shia LaBeouf to do what he wants. But he's like, movies are just flickering lights. And he's like, no, it's not. And then he turns to the documentarian and he goes, he's here watching you and me argue right now. This is real. You and I arguing. And he's like, no, it's not real. It's just lights. It's the only thing real in movies is the audience. And then he was like, well, I guess we disagree.
Which is the, like, even if whether it was like a facetious argument or not, what are you trying to argue? What are
Sorry.
you trying to get out of his performance making this argument? It's so bizarre.
Well, I think probably what was happening was Shia LaBeouf was saying something like, this doesn't feel real to me to do this. And he was probably just telling him that to get him to do what he wants. I think a lot of it was, how do I get Shia LaBeouf away from me right now and to do what I want him to do? Because
Oh
Shia
my.
would plead ignorant with everything. He'd be like, I don't understand what you want, which obviously really got under his skin. There's another interesting moment similar to that where this, see, it's really bad because Coppola does this very old man thing where he's like, he asks rhetorical questions to try to get you to a point, but Shia LaBeouf has these really thoughtful answers. So he says to Shia LaBeouf, like, why do you think I make movies? And Shia LaBeouf's like, because that's what you do. You're a filmmaker. And he's like, no, I don't have to be. I've got other things. I've got the wine company. And he's like, yeah, but fuck that shit. Like, the movies are what you really do, which is obviously insulting to him, right? And he's like, no, why do you think I do it for? I don't do it for money. I don't do it for fame. I do it for fun. Which, by the way, is such bullshit because despite saying I do it for fun, like half the time he's yelling at you to give him exactly what he wants. What's fun about that?
Man, yeah, he's, I don't know, it could be an age thing, but he was also this unhinged in Heart of Darkness.
Right, which is directed by his wife. But he is losing his mind now. He says he had a breakdown. But there's other factors, I think, right? With that, like they're in the jungle and nothing's going right. And like it seemed like it was man versus nature with that movie. Whereas this is like ego versus wallet. One of the interesting things the documentarian Figgis does is he tracks the money for us. It begins by telling us we have a $120 million budget. And then as we see things, he'll put on the screen set locations, $70 million, catering, $40 million. Like, it's so interesting Because he'll like he tallies it up for you, and I don't think I've seen any film documentary ever do that.
Yeah, I think at one point he said the special effects budget, $18 million, like
Yeah.
after they were talking about him firing everybody. I
Yeah.
was like, oh my God. There was also something interesting that I also think was a crazy amount of money, was at the beginning of the movie, Coppola buys a hotel
Oh.
and buys a ho like a motel, renovates it for the actors to live there.
Yeah, and then he also puts like a screening room in there and like editing suites. So he like turns it into like a production thing.
But
But
how
like,
much could you use that after
right,
the.
exactly. Like Disney did that, but then that stayed the Disney studio for like 20 years.
Right, you get your money's
This
worth
is one
afterwards.
movie. Like, what are you gonna do with this motel after?
I wonder if he
Like,
kept it. That's
in the
the thing.
beginning, he's spending money like crazy. And then as time goes on, he's like becoming more stingy.
Naturally, as your money dries up.
As any of us would. What do you think about the rehearsal segment of this? Yeah, he begins with like 2 weeks of rehearsal with the actors before they're actually shooting.
Oh, all that like theater exercises?
Yeah.
I feel like that's useful for maybe not 2 weeks, like maybe a
Yeah.
day or two to like get people, 'cause those theater like play or whatever they call
Yeah.
it, like act exercises are for you to create a camaraderie, right?
Yeah.
Did you need that much of it and for that long?
Yeah.
I just thought it was like he was being really self-indulgent with that.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't think he likes to hold court. He likes to talk. He likes to pontificate, which is what an old filmmaker should do. But you can't be doing that while you're also trying to make a movie. So it seems like a lot of the rehearsal process is him pontificating. And there's a weird vibe in the rehearsal and on the set, which is like there's like a couple different kinds of people. There's like super young people that kind of don't know who he is, but have been told that he's really important, so respect him. You could tell that vibe. And then there's people that are very talented and have a lot of experience and know this is a bad movie, but just want to be work with him anyway. Like Dustin Hoffman clearly knows this is a piece of shit. And then there's a third, smaller, crazier group that actually thinks that's like a cult that drank the Kool-Aid and thinks they're making something beautiful and amazing. That's a very small group. That's a very small group, those people.
I would say Adam Driver was one of those people. Who else would you put in that?
Of the cult,
Yeah.
to me, it's less actors. Well, another actor who is like that is Giancarlo Esposito, who I love, but he's so drinking the fucking Kool-Aid. And you see him in an early table read in like 2000. I think he there was a younger role he read for way back then. But I think most of the cult are behind the scenes people. Like I think one of the production designers seems really like in his cult. It seems less actors.
Okay, yeah.
Actors seem to either be in the camp of, I'm young and I've been told you're important, or hey, this movie's bad, but no one's gonna be mad at me for making it.
I feel like Aubrey Plaza is doing something a little different of
Oh,
like
you're
where
right. You're right. She's her own group.
she's super transparent of like I read the script and this terrifies me and repulses me, but I'm fascinated by it.
Yeah.
And then I had the weirdest Zoom call of my life with Coppola.
Oh God, that Zoom call is so awkward. It's so douchey.
He's so weird. I like that, like, she
Talk about
changed
it.
her Zoom
Describe it
name.
to the listeners.
I don't even know if I can because I was so distracted that she changed her Zoom name to, like, what, Scary Hag or something.
Yeah.
Could you describe it, please?
He's it's a it's an audition basically, although she's obviously a bigger star, so they don't ever call it auditions. So he's like, can you just try some of the lines? Can you try it this way or that way? And then she makes up some joke by her. he asks her something. I forget what it is. And then she repeats it. And then he's like, say that like you're an evil queen. And then he's like, say that like you're a stand-up comic. And she does it. She plays all of his games with him. She's like, she doesn't resist at all, right? Unlike Shia, like whatever he asks for, whether she understands it or not, she just does it. But I think you're right, and she's not part of the, she's not in any of the three that I just, factions that I just mentioned. Because I fact think that she's the only one who knows this is a gigantic piece of shit, and I'm not even taking it seriously. Like, she does the role. She's not there to sabotage it, but you could tell by the way she plays it. You could tell by the way she behaves behind the scene. You could tell by the way she talks to the documentarian. It's almost like a bit to her. Like,
I think it is.
I'm here doing this awful movie.
I also think she sees it as an acting challenge.
Yes.
Like, I feel like
Yeah.
she was really taking that as like, this is not going to change the world, but this might help me as an actor. And
Yeah.
that is interesting. There, yeah, like one of the interviews, she talks to Mike Figgis and tells him that Coppola is super repressed.
Yes, that was very interesting. And then the director's like, "What? Say that again?" And she's like, "What? Nothing. I didn't say anything."
And then is drinking from a goblet, like a golden
Yeah.
goblet that looks like a part of the set for that entire interview.
That's really interesting though, because like when I think of a repressed filmmaker, the first thing that comes to my mind is like Alfred Hitchcock, who like there's a lot of like deviant sexuality in his movie, and I don't mean deviant like the way a conservative might say deviant. I mean deviant like you murder people instead of fucking them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like there's just a lot of using the camera to peep at sex rather than actually address it, and then a guilt built into all that. But I don't see repression in Coppola's movies.
Maybe it's in Megalopolis that we didn't see, so we don't know.
Okay, that's true.
Like,
And we
I
never
feel,
will.
yeah, no, I don't want to see it. There was one point where it's one of those things where my partner Danny and I'll put a movie on. If it's not something that they're, completely against, they'll sit there and play video games or whatever, but eventually they'll get interested. And they were like really fascinated and getting into Megadoc. And there was one point where I think it was Giancarlo trying to make sense of the movie. And Danny just stood up from the couch and was like, no, it's because he's cuckoo. He
Yeah.
is cuckoo. There's no sense here to
Yeah.
build get from this guy. And
Yeah.
I was like, for you to have that kind of reaction, like this is so engaging.
Yeah.
Like,
No, yeah.
wonderful.
It seems at one, and again, I'm talking about a movie I haven't seen, but it seems to me, from the little bit I've seen, to be at one, to be both, again, a contradiction, to be both very heavy-handed and leaning into being moralizing and didactic, and on the other hand, kind of not knowing what it's trying to say.
Yeah, because there were
Like, why
times where
do
the
they have
actor.
Roman names? Like, what's happening? Like, what is really it about?
I think it's like, and I love that we're fully admitting we're not seeing this movie, we're not interested, we're going off
Never
clip.
will.
But it seems like a Roman Empire story, but set in modern New York, but also not modern New
But also
York,
like sci-fi.
but also kind of sci-fi. Yeah, I feel like he, again, like we're going back to, he's trying to do too many ideas. And there was points where like different actors and the crew were saying we're trying to do what he wants, but he changes his
Yeah.
mind.
Yeah.
So like imagine changing your mind throughout production over and over again. And like also the sets were ridiculous. The
Yeah.
amount of sets they built,
Yeah.
and they looked amazing.
Yeah.
Like it looks good, but again, it's like from what we've seen, there's no way this could be a good movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
No way. But it's gorgeous.
Yeah, it does have a big scale, but at the same time, some of the digital effects look bad, probably because they fired that whole team. I mean, he's very disrespectful to them. Like, whether you prefer practical or not, he basically tells like these top rated Hollywood effects people, Like, I think what you do is trash and beneath me. He's super rude to them.
Yeah,
And you
it's
can see
really fucked
why
up.
when she was fired, they all left with her.
It's awful. Like, it's, I
Yeah.
feel, and it goes back to what you were saying. Like, movies are collaborative art, they work best together. And you're treating the people that make your movies the way they do. Like, if you don't have those people, you don't have a movie.
Yeah. See, I can imagine it being really hard to work on that movie, either in front of or behind the camera. Because it seemed like even when you were on set ready to go, you would spend a lot of time waiting for him to do whatever the fuck he's doing, whatever nonsense he's fixating on.
Yeah, and then he gets mad that things are taking long. I'm like, well, you changed direction like
Yeah.
three times.
Right.
Like, they have to reset everything every time you change your mind. Like,
Right.
come on, dude. There was a really cute scene where Aubrey Plaza did this like acting exercise that eventually devolved into arm wrestling with
I found
Dustin
that very
Hoffman.
creepy.
I thought it was fun. I thought it was.
Okay. It's Dustin Hoffman has a very small role in this movie. He admits to the documentarian he kind of doesn't understand what this movie is or what it's about. He seems unhappy to be there. At one point, we see him yell doing a Christian Bale and yelling at somebody on in his eye line. But then at he Aubrey Plaza and him want to completely improvise a scene. So they improvise a scene because she plays like an interviewer. So like they're she's interviewing him, but then they start arm wrestling. But where I found it creepy and kind of pointless was eventually he just starts hitting on her. And it's like, is this where this devolved to? Like, there's got to be a rule in improv, like the scene is shit if you just turn into you're hitting on the person playing the game with you.
The
And you're
one
an
who
80-year-old man and she's like a 35-year-old woman. Like, what are you doing?
yeah, it's gross. I forgot about that part.
Yeah.
That's fair.
And even she kind of seems like, this movie's
That's
got
just,
too many old men on it.
it's like, oh, I gotta deal with this creepy old man again. Well, how many creepy old men did she have to deal with on that set?
At least two. Oh no, three, because you got Voight. Although despite Voight having completely horrible politics, he seems like a sweetie. Like in re like he's as a person, he seems like a genuinely nice person, despite every awful thing we've ever heard about him.
Well, he might be one of those old school Republicans or conservatives,
Smart
rather.
enough to keep his mouth shut if you want to work in Hollywood.
Yeah, but I don't know. I mean, you and I come from the same place, and I feel like you probably have this experience of like there's a certain like generation of conservatives that will like be really will be nice to you, but they'll just not deal with certain politics.
Yeah, it
You
just
ever get
doesn't
that?
come up. Well,
Is
you
it?
see, I don't know if he was he in one of the Transformers movies? At one point, Shia LaBeouf was talking about how he was very close to John Voight, and he saw John Voight as like a mentor. But then they had a huge falling out because of their political differences, and he threatened to beat John Voight up. And then it was like, and then we didn't talk for years. And then it's like, then I got into this program, and part of the steps is apologizing to people. It's like, yeah, I think we know what the program is. But you know
He was
what?
like
I actually
bold.
was, I respected that too. As somebody who's had addiction issues in his life, I was like, you know what? He's sober now. He's open about working on his sobriety. I don't know. I did not think watching this movie, I'd come away from it thinking like, you know what? Shia LaBeouf's a real artist, and thinking Francis Ford Coppola is full of shit.
It's so just looking it up, he Voight worked on Holes, and he
Oh.
also the first Transformers movie.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Totally forgot about Holes.
I think it's funny that you assumed I watched a Transformers movie.
Well, I don't know. I think I was just asking you to see. Maybe I thought you might have known it through osmosis. Maybe you've seen those posters.
That's fair.
So one of the interesting things about the documentary is the star of the film is not Shia LaBeouf. He's a supporting actor. The star of the film is Adam Driver, but the production, he must be a very busy guy. The production was set in which he came very late and then kind of did all his stuff at once. So he's not in any of the rehearsal stuff. He's not part of any of that stuff. And then he didn't really like working with the documentarian. So he's actually the star of Megalopolis, is in it very little. He does do a one-on-one interview, but he kind of didn't want to be recorded actually working. So it's weird.
That was funny because how Mike Figgis, and there was some diary like recordings that he talked to the camera a couple times,
Yes.
and one of them was, yeah, I saw Adam, I ran to Adam Driver like, oh, it's me, it's Mike Figgis. And Adam's like, wow, oh hey, how are you, did you just get here? And Figgis like, I've been here
Yeah.
the
I also like in Mike Figgis's view of the world, everybody knows him.
time.
Like he's the most like he's like the most well-known filmmaker of all time.
I honestly, I didn't even realize he directed Leaving Las Vegas. I didn't even hear about him until watching this movie.
Yeah. So there are two big things that this documentary does not show at all. One is the reports of Francis Ford Coppola sexually harassing extras, which was a
Oh.
scandal that happened during the making of the film.
Oh my God. I did not know about that.
Okay, so there's a scene that you see them record, you see them filming, recording. You see them filming, which is like a nightclub scene. And apparently Coppola was like maybe drunk and kind of going around and like kissing and hugging and touching the young extras. And he was like, I was just trying to set the mood. And it's like,
Ew.
you're their boss and an 80-year-old man. Stop kissing people without their permission.
Oh, God.
So
That's
that's not in
awful.
it at all and not mentioned in it. And the other thing is the death of Eleanor. And I understand that it's about the production of the movie, but the director's wife passes away in the middle of production, and his wife for like 50 years. And I looked up later on that she had an illness that she suffered with a long time, which made me go, oh, maybe I'm being too hard on Coppola. Maybe what we're not seeing is that Coppola is dealing with his wife being sick. But at the same time, part of me feels like, what a selfish asshole that your wife is really sick and you're like, I gotta go make a movie. I don't know. But it just felt weird. Like you see them having on the set, they have a celebrate, they have a party for their anniversary. And everyone like, and then like the next scene, you just see like a graphic that says like Eleanor Coppola and then like the dates of her life. And it was like, holy shit, she's gone? And then like not a single like, they didn't talk about if there was a break, how long the break was, how did the break of, no one says, Coppola, how do you feel? Your wife died? Like, I don't know. I just feel like it feels very absent from the
I'm
movie.
wondering about that. I'm wondering if it's one of those things. So, this is anecdotally, but I've met adults who deal with grief and tragedy just putting themselves through work. And I'm not trying to give Coppola the benefit of the doubt necessarily, but I wonder if it was something that people were afraid to mention to him and he was just putting all his energy and grief to get this movie done.
I totally understand being afraid to mention it outside of like a casual, oh, I'm sorry. But I do think that Mike Figgis should have had the guts to ask him about it. You're making a documentary. You are friends. He gave you the job because he knows you.
I can't even imagine being friends with someone like that. Like, that's crazy.
At one point, Coppola says, I'm too old and grouchy for this kind of work. And it's the most truthful thing he says in the whole movie.
Well, he doesn't really talk about himself, right? Like Coppola. Like,
No.
he mostly just talks about whatever horse shit that's on his mind at that time in the documentary.
Right. But he will say, like, I know what I'm doing, or I've been doing this for 50 years. Like when he's having it out with Shia LaBeouf. At one point, Shia LaBeouf is like, yeah, towards the end, we were very blunt with each other. There was no pleasantries left. There was no couching things in a nice way. Oh, there's a really interesting scene that's supposed to be an argument, but Shia LaBeouf, being the consummate actor, starts fighting his scene partner. Like he just like improvises fighting, like fist fighting. And you see Coppola being like, looking at it like, what the fuck is happening? And then they call cut, and Coppola's like, all right, let's do it again. And then the other actor in the scene goes to Coppola and goes, I'm not doing that shit again. And then Shia LaBeouf runs out and he's like, where else would the scene go? He's got his fucking feet on my desk. Of course I'm gonna hit him. And Coppola, but you know, it's, again, that I obviously that's crazy behavior and an unprofessional becoming of a decent person. But at the same time, I feel like Shia was embodying what Coppola said he wanted. Like, if you listen to Coppola's bullshit, it is like, yeah, we're artists, let's play around, let's play, let's figure it, let's find things, let's create things. And Shia was really doing that. But Coppola was just like, I don't know. He has a line of bullshit that's not who he really is. He's mythologized himself, I think, in a way. Coppola.
Do you think he's done making movies?
Yes. Well, I mean, another thing that happened after this movie was, first of all, it went to Cannes and it got a standing ovation, which is how this movie ends. But I think that was a very lifetime achievement standing ovation. He did a screening for industry insiders, like everybody, Netflix, everybody, because he wanted to find a distributor. You know, he was like, okay, I made the movie, I produced it, but who's going to put it out? And apparently it was disastrous. Everything was awkward. No one liked it. People were like being quiet and like no one made any offers for it.
Oh, God.
And like there were like anonymous quotes from people there that were like, you know, we came in very respectful, but we were like, what the hell is this? No one wants to see this. Real embarrassing shit. The question would be, is anyone else going to give him money? And I don't know if anyone will. I mean, to give him a little credit here, nobody's getting money. I mean, Francis Ford Coppola did, I'm sorry, Martin Scorsese did The Irishman for Netflix. Like, the movie industry kind of like, unless you're like, I got a Marvel movie idea, like, they're not, these guys aren't, even look at like Lynch's last thing was Twin Peaks for Showtime. You know what I mean? Like, if obviously he died, but would Lynch ever make another movie the way he did? Would he have to pay for it himself? I think the only way Coppola does another movie is if he pays for it himself, but I don't think he has any money left.
He doesn't. I've been looking up like stuff he's been selling. He sold his Belize Island getaway for
Poor guy,
$1.8 million.
he's really slumming it. He had
Yeah,
to sell his island.
he sold a watch and another San Francisco newspaper for $11 million. What is this made of?
What it's just, I imagine he's like Citizen Kane. It's just like him, and it's just a bunch of shit like in a room, puzzles and shit, and he's like selling it off. Yeah.
Yeah, it seems like just going off like stuff I'm quickly Googling now as we're talking is like when he ends movies and makes success, he would buy properties and stuff and then mortgage them to finance more stuff. So he's been doing this kind of crap for years. It's only now where he put like everything
Everything.
in it.
Right. And it's because he couldn't get funding for all these years. No one was interested. And I think it's because of the script. I think, you know, put away the bullshit artiste thing. Just good filmmaking. What he should have done was taken the script that he wrote, called out a first draft, and then hired a real seasoned good writer and say, here's the script, here's my first draft. Please make it good. And then taking that and tried to get it made.
Do you think, again, a movie we have, I cannot emphasize this enough, we have not seen this movie.
No, we have not.
Do you think it maybe would have worked better as like a mini series or something? Like, why did it have to
It's
be a movie?
very hard to answer that question having not seen it. What it seems from what I see, what I glean from the documentary and from what I've heard from other people who have seen it and read from people who've seen it, the whole thing kind of makes no sense and kind of just goes on and on, rambling but not saying anything. So I
Yeah, like
think
old
a
people.
miniseries, I don't think would have done any Like, if it were like a Netflix show, I don't think it would have done anything. But again, he's also very stuck in the past, so he would never make a Netflix show. He'd be like, no, it's gotta be in the theater.
Right. Well, I'm thinking like it's from what we've seen in the clips in Megadoc, it seems like a family drama, which
Yeah.
for the last 10 years or so, family dramas have been really big,
Yeah.
right? I'm thinking, I mean, running the gamut, but like I think the first thing that comes to mind is, oh God, now I'm blank. But anyway.
Family dramas?
Yeah, like rich families fucking each other over.
Oh, what's the one where he fucks the dirt? Is that what you're thinking about? Saltburn.
Oh God.
Now, are you thinking about?
Well, I was thinking more of television shows. So I'm thinking of like Game of Thrones, which is like rich people fucking each other over. Wasn't Succession about a rich family fucking each other over?
Yes, that's true. That's true.
Like stuff like that. I'm like, why? If that was the realm of this movie that has a lot, and also the cast is pretty big. If there's like a lot of characters and we're supposed to be following them, right? Hypothetically, wherever this movie is,
Yeah.
and their relationships with each other and the world that they're in, why wouldn't we spend more time with them? Like, shouldn't it be a character-driven movie?
I don't think it is. I think it's driven like by this sci-fi concept about like it feels very like from what I've seen, it feels very like I don't know, like Socratic dialogues. It feels very like he's trying to come up with the best city state and philosophizing about how one reaches that. Because
Yeah.
even the dialogue in the movie seems like Socratic dialogues, like people just pontificating at each other.
Right. A book. I don't know. I'm just trying to think of like what other media
Book.
could this work better? I don't know. But also looking at Coppola's assets, he owns a all movie hotel that's a hotel and a post-production facility in Georgia. This guy really diversified. It's kind of
Well,
interesting.
that's the thing he built for this movie. So, what's he gonna do with it?
It's you rent it. You go
I guess
there.
that,
It's a
well, there is a
hotel.
lot of production in Georgia. So, that's actually probably a smart thing.
Yeah, I'm just, well, what I mean is like he owns a lot of different businesses,
Yeah.
right? So like at the very least, he's smart enough to do that, and diversify his portfolio, but he's stupid enough to lose all that, like so much money trying to make
Right.
these ego trip movies.
Well, you know, the filmmaker closest to him, model wise, is George Lucas, who was like George Lucas, like was kind of his apprentice. But Lucas has the toys, so Lucas will always have a never ending stream of money from the toys and the video games and shit.
Wait, he still
Whereas,
retains the rights to?
oh yeah.
Oh, shoot, that's really smart.
Actually, at this point, when he sold it all to Disney for billions, I guess he probably sold the toys too. But you know, before that, like he's a gajillionaire, right? Coppola doesn't have that. You know what I mean? There are no like, there's no kids are like, oh, there's a new Don Corleone action figure. He had to do like wine, which is, it's like blackface for Italian people. Like,
Okay.
I don't mean to be this, it's like disrespectful, but like the director of The Godfather selling wine. Why don't you sell bullets? Like what? Like why don't you sell pinstripe suits? Like what are you doing, Francis Ford Coppola?
Oh my God.
Here's a couple of wine. By the way, Lucas, his last thing, not that he's about to die, but his latest thing is he that huge museum he opened or is going to open soon, the Museum of Narrative Art. Which is like, have you seen it?
No.
Oh my God, look it up. It's like this beautiful building, amazing architecture. And actually, I would even say that there's no ego behind it because he originally envisioned it as a being about narrativity and narrative art throughout all of human expression. And it was the investors that were like, you have to put a Star Wars exhibit in. And he was like, no, I don't want to. But then eventually he relented. They were like, people know you made this. You have to put a Star Wars, you have to put something Star Wars in it. But it seems like it's so much more than Star Wars.
Oh, okay, so it's expected to open September 22nd, 2026.
Oh, wow. But he's been making it for a long time.
That's crazy.
Where is it?
It's in LA.
That's awesome.
Exposition Park. I don't know where that is, but I don't know nothing about LA. I was never interested in going, but this sounds pretty cool.
The building looks like a ship. It's very crazy.
I love it.
I really, you know what? I hope Lucas shifts into Disney gear and just does shit like this. Like, just get super obsessed with like architecture and like creating things like this. Why not?
I mean, what else has he been doing?
Just not nothing really. Nothing at all. That's basically it. That's Mega Doc. It's on Criterion Channel, which I've said before, it's one of my two favorite streaming services. It's cheap as hell, and you get so much good stuff. And unlike most other streamers, it has a different delivery system. It does have new movies every month, but it's about different packages. So like every month we'll have different topics, and in those topics or in those folders will be like eight movies. Like there's a new Wuthering Heights coming out. Right now there is a thing that's like every version of Wuthering Heights. So like I love it. But Mega Doc is on there. I absolutely think it's worth seeing if you're interested in filmmaking, if you're interested in people making gigantic messes. I think it's totally worth it.
Oh, I as someone who one of my favorite subgenres of film is movies about productions.
Yeah.
It's great. Just getting an idea of what's going on in people's heads or what they're experiencing in a movie, because what they're experiencing is completely different than what we see.
Sure. And a lot of, to be, you know, a lot of amazing movies, all-time classic movies, had really troubled, crazy productions that you would have never known at the time this is gonna work. This is not one of them. Although there are people who still drink the Kool-Aid that are like, no, you wait. In 30 years, everyone's gonna be saying Megalopolis. Megalopolis is gonna be it's gonna be a classic in the future. I doubt that. That did kind of happen to Eyes Wide Shut. When Eyes Wide Shut came out, it was not well liked by audiences, but now it seems to have a better reputation. But critics seemed to like it for the most part at the time. So it's not like it was re completely reviled at the time. But I do think Eyes Wide Shut, which was another director's last film, Eyes Wide Shut, I think, is people talk about it in much better terms now than they did at the time.
But at the time, did anyone talk about it like, how would you say this? Did anyone talk about like it was an ego trip? Because I feel like, which
No.
again, I feel
Well,
like.
it's interesting. No, I don't think so. Although it was something he tried to make for a long time. It was that kind of thing. But he didn't spend his own money on it, I don't think.
Well, I also
And he
think,
was 70, by the way. I just looked it up. 70, maybe that's the cutoff.
Akira Kurosawa, going back to what we said, at 80 directed Dreams. And that's pretty solid.
Yeah, Dreams is pretty good.
Yeah. So
But it is
that.
an anthology.
Okay.
I feel like it's less juggling. You know what I mean? Like you don't like you just have to make little bits work.
Okay. That's fair. That's
I'm not
fair.
trying to take anything away from Kurosawa.
No,
I'm just
yeah,
like,
no,
and I'm not
that's
trying to
fine.
be totally ageist. I'm more making fun of artists and how they just as they grow, their heads grow up their asses.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like, I can't, I mean, I'm generalizing, but I can't think of someone who was so far up their own ass about their work that was going to be amazing, and it ends up being amazing. Like, I please direct it to your audience. Like, prove us wrong. Give us some shithead artists who thought their art one piece, whatever it is, movie, television,
Yeah.
painting, sculpture, that was going to change the world and actually did. Please.
Well, I really think you're barking up the wrong tree if your thesis statement is change the world. Like,
Yes.
what?
Well, I think that's my point. It's like you can't be so far up your own ass
Yeah.
that you that it will be as amazing as you think it is. That I don't think it's possible.
I do believe that pop culture man children will change the world once people start listening to it. I think it's really going to change the world. I think more people are going to have very strong takes on Masters of the Universe. This has been PCMC, Pop Culture Man Children. I'm your host, Mike Bongiorno. I didn't say that at the beginning, but you know the fuck I am. I'm here with my friend and my friend and yours, Nadia Cater. Nadia, thank you for being here.
Mike, thanks so much. This was great.
All right, we end every episode by saying
Go bye-bye.